This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 100.5 FM.
There is little else more fundamental in a democracy than the right to vote. And for hundreds of years, people have been fighting to extend that right to as many people as possible. Changes to the Elections Act a few years ago may deny some of the most vulnerable in our society a chance to make their mark on Election Day. Raji Mangat is a lawyer with the BC Civil Liberties Association. The BCCLA were allowed intervener status in a case argued before the BC Court of Appeal earlier this year, which challenged Canada's voter ID law. And she joins us now on the phone. Good morning, Raji.
Good morning.
What changes were made to Canada's voter ID law?
So effective in June of 2007, amendments were made to the federal voting law that requires all voters to prove their identity and residence before casting a ballot in a federal election. And prior to these amendments, proof of identity and residence was not required to cast a vote as long as you were already on the electoral list.
And how were people able to identify themselves before changes were made to that?
So, before the amendments, if you were already on the electoral list, what you would need to do is go to your polling station, provide your name and your address to the clerk at the polling station. The clerk would confirm that your name was on the list of electors, cross it off, and pass you a ballot. You would go and vote. If they had any doubts about your identity, they had the discretion. They could request proof of identity and residence. Or you could swear an oath at the polling station. And if you weren't on the list of electors, then you could register on polling day with the proof of identity and residence that you would need to sort of prove that you were a Canadian citizen and eligible to vote. But now, with the amendment, all voters, regardless of whether they're on the elector list or not, need to present proof of identity and residence or be vouched by another elector in the same polling division who has the authorized identification. So, you know, we had this sort of system where if you were already on the list, you would just need to confirm that you are who you say you are, and they would check that against the list and give you a ballot. Now we have the additional step where you need to have, at the time that you go to vote, the required identification to sort of additionally prove, I suppose, who you are. And so what our feeling is at the BCCLA is that adds an additional layer that makes it more difficult for certain groups of people in our society to cast a ballot.
Who are the people that are most affected by that?
The people that are most affected by this are the people that are the most vulnerable and marginalized in our political process already. So we're talking about people who are street homeless, people who don't have any fixed or permanent address, people who live a fairly transient lifestyle. We're talking about people who live in rural and remote areas that may make it more difficult for them to vote, people with certain disabilities, people who may even just be new to a neighborhood may find it more difficult to vote because they would not have the requisite identification now, and they aren't able to just swear an oath at the polling station as they were before.
Raji, what was the government's rationale for wanting to change the law?
It's pretty interesting because we don't really see that there's any clear or compelling evidence that we had a problem with people impersonating other people or otherwise voting fraudulently at the polling station. I mean, the government did have a report that was tabled in Parliament where a number of suggestions were made for making the voting process more efficient and generally sort of bolstering the public's confidence. However, there wasn't any real evidence that, you know, we had a problem with fraud in Canadian elections. And moreover, voter identification requirements only deal with a particular type of fraud. They're only going to deal with people who are pretending to be somebody else or otherwise sort of not representing themselves correctly at a polling station. This isn't going to deal with, you know, other larger problems that we might have with how elections are being handled. So this doesn't do anything to address the concern that people had earlier this year and last year about people getting robocalls and being told about, you know, going to the wrong polling station. This is going to address, and voter identification really only addresses a very specific problem and one that we really don't see as happening. So it is quite interesting that the government would choose to make it more difficult for people to vote at a time when we see that voter participation rates are low and declining, instead of sort of making it more easy for people to vote and encouraging participation in the political process. So it is quite interesting, you know, what precipitated these changes. We don't see that there was really a problem to address.
Now, tell me about the case that was presented at the BC Court of Appeal earlier this year.
Yeah, so this case was, it was heard before at the BC Supreme Court back in 2009, and there was a decision in 2010. The decision was that while the voter identification laws are on the face of it a violation of the Section 3 right to vote, the infringement was not unjustifiably broad. Like, it basically that the negative effect of this law are modest, and so it amounts to mostly a minor inconvenience for a minority of electors. So that decision, you know, while we were happy to see that the infringement of the right to vote was found, the fact that it was saved under Section 1 of the Charter, you know, where there's sort of a cost-benefit analysis done, that was problematic. And so the individuals who brought the suit are three people. One of them is an Aboriginal anti-poverty advocate, and she's been homeless at various points in her past and has, testified as to difficulty she would have in having the required identification. One of the other individuals who brought the suit is a gentleman, an Aboriginal gentleman, who's lived on the downtown east side for a while and works with the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. And the third individual is a woman who's visually impaired. And so she actually was not able to vote in the 2008 general election. She came to the polling station with what she thought was the appropriate ID. She had a card from the Canadian National Institute for the Blind. That was not the required identification. She had documents at home, but she was unable to see them, and sort of it was difficult for her to go back home to get those documents and bring them back. So she didn't end up casting a ballot at all. So these are the three individuals who brought the suit, and basically, you know, their challenge is very similar to the arguments that the BCCLA made, just in respect of how difficult this makes it for certain marginalized populations to cast a ballot, and again pointing out that there really didn't seem to be a need for this law in the first place, but rather that the fact that, you know, we're making it more difficult for people to vote in the trade-off for possibly marginally more confidence in the fact that people aren't impersonating other people at the polling station, that's kind of not really the right balance that we want to strike in a free and democratic society.
Now, I want to pick up on a point that you made a few minutes ago, that the voter ID law was found unconstitutional under the Charter of Rights and Freedom, mm-hmm. but the first court under Section 1 agreed that there was with the concern for voter fraud. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, just kind of unpack their thinking there?
Yeah, I mean, so what happens under the Constitution is once, you know, an infringement of a charter right is found, then in many occasions we go to Section 1 of the Charter, where we do a balancing exercise about whether, whether the infringement nevertheless constitutes a reasonable limit prescribed by law and demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. So there's a balancing exercise that happens under the Charter, under Section 1 of the Charter. And so in doing that balancing exercise, Madam Justice Smith, who is the judge at the BC Supreme Court, looked at the balancing the deleterious and the salutary effects. That's part of the test that is done under Section 1. And so she was, you know, looking at whether the benefits of the law, of the voter identification law, are worth the costs they impose. And in doing that balance, she found that the benefit of, you know, the fact that this is going to bolster confidence in the political system, even though she acknowledged that these effects are modest, that these positive effects are modest, because there was little evidence of voter fraud in the first place. But, you know, nevertheless, this would allow people to have more assurance that votes in federal elections are being cast by people who are entitled to vote, and that they're cast in the polling district where the person is resident. So, you know, she sort of found that while that benefit is marginal, it still is a benefit, and it overcomes what, in her view, was going to be a minor inconvenience for a minority of electors. And so in challenging that decision when it was appealed, a big part of the argument was looking at the balancing, because, you know, as I said, the court had already found that, yes, prima facie, there was a violation of Section 3 of the Charter, which is the section that, you know, guarantees our right to vote. But the real you know, where the rubber hits the road, so to speak, is in looking at the balancing there, looking at whether, nevertheless, the law might still be justifiable by the government. And so it's there where we argued, and as did the plaintiffs, who were the appellants on the appeal, that, you know, we really need to look at the importance of the right we're talking about. We're talking about the freedom of people to cast a ballot in a federal election. This is a right that goes to the heart of our democracy. And so, you know, when we're looking at a right that is so significant, and we're talking about populations that are already so marginalized in our political process, you know, we need to do that balance in a different way. And so a lot of what was argued at the BC Court of Appeal this past February was looking at how that Section 1 analysis should happen.
What are your hopes for the case? How do you think it went?
I think it went, I mean, it's hard to say. It's always difficult to say with the court. They're very circumspect. They don't usually show their hand at the hearing. And, of course, as you know, we're waiting for a decision. So it may be some months before we know what actually is what happened. But I'm cautiously optimistic. I think the court is really alert to the fact that, you know, this law does have a disproportionate impact on people that, as I said, are the most vulnerable and the most disenfranchised in our population already. So I think the court was really alive to that concern, and I'm cautiously optimistic that that, you know, we made strong arguments in favor of seeing the law struck down.
Well, it's been great talking with you this morning, Raji. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on your program. It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Raji Mangat. She's a lawyer with the BC Civil Liberties Association. You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@cooperadio.org.